The Expat Files with John Mueller, Mondays and Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, not the version they give you in those glossy travel magazines or the picture they paint for you in those international traveler websites, where they're only trying to sell you something. What's it really like for expats living in Latin America? Well, it's time to take off those rose-colored glasses and find out. So let's get started. Now, I get a lot of emails about Brazil. It's been in the news a ton lately, and it seems like there's been a concerted effort to put a positive spin on everything and anything that comes out of Brazil. Take, for instance, the fact that the U.S. State Department has not blacklisted Brazil as a destination for American tourists. Even though, if you go down to Rio de Janeiro, which is about the only tourist destination that first world people think of when they think of Brazil, they think of the girls in string bikinis, the girl from Ipanema, Copacabana Beach and all that, Sugarloaf Mountain and Carnival. And all that stuff is in and around Rio too. But the fact is, if you're going to stay at one of the beach hotels in Rio, even the very decent and high-end ones that you book, and the ones that travel agents up north offer in package deals, well, I've been down there myself, and what you see at those Rio hotels are signs that say, please do not walk on the beach at night or alone. You do so at your own risk. How would you like that for a nice Rio vacation? They're telling you not to take a nice morning stroll or a sunset walk along the beach, which kind of defeats the reason why you went down there in the first place now, doesn't it? The fact is, there's more petty crime, robberies, and thefts on that beach, that famous Copacabana Strip, than there is, I think, on any other famous beach in the world. And here's a great statistic for you. Right now, this week, in the papers, throughout many cities in Brazil right now, the police are on strike because they only make $110 a month. And when they ask for a 17% raise, well, the government didn't give it to them. So now they're holding out. Even in some of the smaller cities in Brazil, they have 100 homicides a week. And as expat Eddie once pointed out to me, in Brazil, the police not only have to buy their own uniforms, they have to buy their own bullets for their guns, too. But again, buying your own bullets is not so unusual in Latin America. The police departments in 15 out of 20 countries down here make the cops buy their own bullets, too, just like Brazil. Which is probably a good thing. That way, you don't shoot first and ask questions later, because you gotta pay for the bullets. And if you're a cop in a place like Brazil where you only make $110 a month, which is a little under $30 a week, anyway, bullets are a very precious commodity to a guy like that. And since the cost of a standard 9mm round down here in Latin America is about 50 cents to a buck a bullet, if you relate that to the gross income that a cop makes, every time he fires a round and has to replace that bullet out of his own pocket, he's spending about 1/30th of his monthly income. In other words, let's say a first world cop makes $48,000 a year. Now, I know a lot of them make almost double that, but let's use 48K because it's easy to do the numbers. That's $4,000 a month. So if a first world cop had to buy his own bullets, and the cost of a bullet was 1/30th of his monthly salary, like it is for a third world Brazilian cop, that means every time he shot one bullet and had to replace it, it would cost him $133 because 1/30th of his $4,000 a month salary is $133. So every time he emptied his revolver, which is 6 shots, he'd have to pony up $800 just to reload. Which of course is ridiculous because first world cops don't have to buy their own bullets. And by the way, first world cops don't use revolvers anymore. Not since the 1970s and 80s. Now they use Glock 19s, or some variant of that, and they shoot 19 in a clip. Now imagine that. You empty your Glock, and you gotta pay for 19 bullets. Hypothetically, of course, for this example. So if a first world cop emptied out his Glock 19 and he had to pay for his bullets, he'd have to come up with $2,500 to replace them, as we extrapolated from that Brazilian cop's salary of $110 a month. Knowing that 9mm bullets in Brazil cost about a buck each, and that cops have to pay for them themselves. Now, I bet that if first world cops had to pay $133 a bullet, they'd go back to a 6-shot revolver instead of a 19-shot Glock. Now, how I got into this discussion in the first place is because everybody's talking about how Brazil has been pulling itself up by the bootstraps like no other Latin American country and has been creating for itself a solid middle class. And in fact, these days, everybody's calling Brazil the motor of Latin America. Well, it may be the motor of Latin America, but it's a motor that's idling compared to the first world. Because let's take, for example, police. They're considered throughout the world to be middle class. Governments pay the police a middle-class salary so they don't go wanting for things and have the temptation to take kickbacks on the job from criminals just to supplement their income and live a halfway decent life. So following along that line of thinking, you pay your policemen a middle-class salary and you'll have a pretty honest police force. So let's look at Brazil again. If they're paying their police $110 a month, which by all rights should be a solid middle-class salary in Brazil, based of course on the fact that cops throughout the world get middle-class salaries, right? Wrong. Not in the case of Brazil. Well, then you can see, really, that the motor of Latin America isn't what it's cracked up to be now, is it? How in the world can you have a law-abiding society when most of your cops are on the take just to feed their families? And Brazil is especially noted for underpaying its cops. In the rest of Latin America, the cops make at least double that, anywhere from $250 to $500 a month, which at least puts them in the middle class, according to Latin American standards. Anyway, if you go down to Brazil, you'll find that crime is so bad, it's really hard to believe that it's not on the U.S. State Department blacklist for U.S. tourists. Not that many U.S. tourists make Brazil an actual tourist destination. It's just so damn far, and it costs at least $1,000 to fly there from anywhere in the U.S., and that's when you're getting an ultra-cheap fare. Normally, it's about $1,500 to $2,000, and that's just for the airfare, so you don't get many takers from the States. Not when you can get a week in Cancun or Costa Rica for under a grand, all included. Anyway, after being in Latin America a long time and seeing Rio and Brazil in general up front and close, I finally realized why Brazil's not on the U.S. State Department blacklist for travel when other countries like Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua are. It's the fact that Brazil is one huge country and there are tons of transnational corporations, most of them based in the U.S., that do a huge amount of business there, mostly in agriculture and mining. And if Brazil was on the U.S. State Department's crap list, not only would the first world tourism that they do have dry up, but first world transnational companies would think twice about coming down and investing too. So it's all political. While tiny Latin American countries that don't mean anything to the first world economy or the United States, like Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, it's easy enough for the U.S. State Department to put those little countries on the crap list because nobody really gives a damn up in the first world. Since Brazil's about the fifth largest country in the world by population with about 200 million people, and little countries like Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras have only between 6 and 8 million people, so who cares about them? What's a 6 to 8 million person market compared to a 200 million person market? Practically nothing. So my point is, don't believe what the U.S. State Department tells you. When they put out their tourist warnings, it's all based on politics, not on reality. To me, Brazil is much more dangerous for an expat to go down and just hang around in than any of the countries in Central America that always seem to make the blacklist published by the U.S. State Department. Now here's a great statistic you might be interested in. I was in Guatemala City recently, which by the way is always on the U.S. State Department's blacklist for U.S. tourists. Guatemala City has about 1 million people, or 2 million in the metropolitan area, so they do get their share of tourists, even though it's on the blacklist. And most of them are backpacking eco-tourists, out to see those magnificent Mayan ruins, and because it's dirt cheap over there. Anyway, Guatemala City's got about 20 backpacker hotels and hostels listed in the various guides, and the Lonely Planet guide happens to have its own list of the worst and best backpacker hotels and hostels in Guatemala City. Anyway, I went to the one that was rated tops by Lonely Planet. Not because I wanted to stay there, I just wanted to check out high-end backpacker living, if there is such a thing. Because you'll know that if you've been listening to my show for any length of time, I have my minimum standards when I travel. And my minimum standard is I need my own personal bathroom. I don't want to share bathroom facilities with a bunch of backpackers who haven't taken a bath in a week, who smell worse than the kid on the corner juggling oranges for a living. I mean, I know I'm in the wrong place when I walk into a backpacker hotel and there's a little sign on the wall that says, please wash yourself, your clothes, and your bedding regularly. Bedbug infestations are difficult to manage. Your cooperation is appreciated, the management. And I'm not kidding you, I have seen signs like that posted in high-rated backpacker hotels and hostels. Now, if you're a backpacker, a sign like that might comfort you, but it just scares me. Anyway, I went to that number one rated backpacker hotel in Guatemala City to have a look. And it was filled with the usual blonde, tall, backpacker Scandinavian girls. And the obligatory pair of young blonde Mormon guys. In their white shirts, black pants, and suspenders. You know the type. Anyway, I learned something very interesting at that backpacker hotel. When I spoke to the manager about the fact that Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Salvador are on the U.S. State Department's travel warning list, and the manager shook his head and said, you know, I've been running this place for a couple of years now, and I've had at least 3,500 backpackers stay at this place. And in all that time, only two of those 3,500 have ever been mugged. That's just a little more than one in 2,000 backpackers. And quite a record, really, considering those are the people most likely to get mugged, because they are by nature the most adventurous and the most willing to take a chance to go to the most far out places. Many times all alone or just with a backpacking friend or two. And it turns out a high percentage of backpackers in Latin America are single women or women in pairs, with no male to be seen at all. And that seems to be a common thing mostly among Scandinavian women. Don't ask me why. It seems like they never got around to reading the U.S. State Department warning. And why should they? Anyway, backpackers by nature are very adventurous. They like river rafting and mountain climbing and jungle trekking and rainforest canopy tours and all that. But only if they're cheap, of course. And here's one thing I found out. You propose a hot, wet, sticky afternoon to any backpacker and you'll say, "You can count me in, let's go." And backpackers almost never take taxis. They're always on the chicken bus, which I don't recommend, of course. But I talked about chicken buses in a past show, so if you want to check that out, just go into the archives. Just know that chicken buses are often packed to the gills. And if you and your backpack are wedged into an overloaded bus, sometimes a young kid with a sharp knife will slice right through it and relieve you of a couple items. And it's impossible to even know when that happens, because those buses can get so densely packed, you feel like you're in a sweaty box of elbows and buttholes. So backpackers are prime targets for petty theft. Even though to first world expats, backpackers don't look like they've got two nickels to rub together. Every petty thief knows that these guys carry some cash with them, and that they don't mind sleeping in a cheap flea bag motel once in a while. And places like that are almost always found in the bad parts of the city. Because if those $5 to $15 a night hostels were in a good part of town, they'd be double the price. And backpackers will go out of their way to save a few bucks. That's just the nature of backpackers. And the point is here, if anyone's a target for petty crime and theft, it's backpackers, because they do things and go places that the average non-backpacking tourist would never dream of. Anything for a bit of adventure, and that's what backpacking is all about. So when the manager of a popular backpacker hostel in the middle of a Latin American city that's been on the U.S. State Department blacklist for years, when that manager told me that his statistics say that even backpackers rarely get assaulted, you gotta know that State Department warning is nothing but politics. And here's the real facts. Backpackers don't follow my guidelines when I say it's very prudent to keep out of the dangerous zones. Every big city in Latin America has its good and bad zones, just like every first world city. And once you know them, you'll be far away from the bad guys and the places where the vast majority of crimes are committed. Take me, for example. I've been down here 21 years and I go everywhere, but I also know what places are safe and dangerous, what apartments, zones, and subdivisions I should keep away from at all costs, and which ones I could walk through safely day or night. And those two times that I was robbed, it happened during the first 2 years I was down here, when I was a starry-eyed tourist who didn't know much of anything. And in the last 18 or 19 years, I haven't had any problems at all. How many of you up in the first world can say that? I know Americans up in Chicago and New York who've been mugged 3 times in 1 year. And I'm sure that happens down here too, but 95% of the time, that stuff happens in the zones, districts, and subdivisions that we never recommend that you hang out in. And if you want more details about that, I talked about how to determine the safe and the dangerous zones in a given city, and you can look that up in the archives. But once again, getting back to the Brazil thing, the fact that everyone says that it's the powerhouse of Latin America. And though it might be because it's got 200 million people, half of those people still live on $2 or $3 a day. And the crime statistics are just out of sight because there's so many gangs. If you've ever been down there a while and got a little bit outside the high rent areas, or you've gone to one of the northern areas in Brazil, the ones that practically get no publicity at all, not even in obscure travel magazines or websites, well, all I gotta say, if you decide to move down to one of those places, it might not be a bad idea to know a little bit of karate. As for me, there are 10,000 places in Latin America I'd rather be than Brazil. And sure, the beaches of Rio are excellent, and they've got all those Brazilian bathing beauties with those Brazilian wax jobs. And you've got Carnival and Sugarloaf Mountain and all that. But I can tell you 1,000 other places in Latin America, on the Caribbean side, most all of them, that have as good or better beaches. And for one thing, the beach spots on the Caribbean coast are beautiful and warm 365 days a year, unlike Rio, which does have a fairly long cold season where you can't go on the beach with a bikini or you'll get goosebumps on your goosebumps. Because you see, Rio is just far enough south that you get the four-season effect again, though in reverse from the seasons up in the northern hemisphere. And about the only two good things about Brazil that I can talk about is the fact that it's heavy into biodiesel and renewable resources, so it's not heavily dependent on OPEC at all, even though bioenergy products down there are artificially subsidized by the government, which is always a bad thing in the end. Anyway, another very positive thing about Brazil, in my eyes, is the little-known fact that Brazil is the only major country in the world that does not allow derivatives trading or derivatives listed as assets by its banks. That means when the next shoe drops on the economic front, and derivatives are shown once again to be nothing but black holes that the U.S. Fed and international money funds will have to try to plug once again, Brazil, anyway, will be in good shape. Well, maybe not in good shape, but possibly the only one with halfway sound money after the fallout. Now, changing the subject a bit, I often get emails asking me about how people can come down to Latin America and get first world style jobs or jobs with transnationals. And these emails almost always come from career people who are looking to jump ship up in the first world because sounds like they've had it. And it's obvious that they don't think they have any good business ideas because they want to come down and work in the same career that they've been trained for. Or it could be they just don't have a good business idea at the moment. Or they just don't feel comfortable opening a small business because they don't have the training they think is necessary to open a small business. And really, who has until you actually roll your sleeves up and try to do it yourself? Anyway, not everyone's cut out to run a small business, whether in the first world or down here. And then again, some expats are simply scared. They want to leave the first world all right. But they don't speak Spanish, so they feel they have to work for a transnational to survive. And maybe they even have a decent savings, something that could hold them over for 3 to 5 years. At least that's what they think. But here's the story on living off your savings. If you're a single person, let's say, because we're going to make it easy here, and you have $100,000 in savings, which isn't a lot in the first world by any means, but it's really something down here, believe me. Up in the first world, you're about in the 50% tax bracket, whether you know it or not, or whether you want to believe it or not. Even if you tell me you're only paying 30 or 35% in personal income taxes, you're forgetting about your state taxes, sales taxes, licenses, fees. Not to mention, if you own your home, you're going to pay some pretty hefty property taxes. And even if you're renting, you're still paying property tax because the cost is built into your rent. So you're paying it, okay? Now, I could go through all the analysis of how I know that you're paying 50% or even more on taxes up in the first world. But let's just call it 50% to make it easy. Now, suppose you make $50,000 a year and you're taxed at 50%. That means you got $25,000 in spendable income. Now, if you come down to Latin America thinking that you're going to live like a first world person down here, it doesn't take $25,000 a year. You could live easily the same way you lived up in the first world on half of that, as long as you're not in a high-volume tourist area. Now, admittedly, if you're making 50 grand a year up in the States and you're only living on 25,000, after taxes, of course, you aren't living high on the hog. The fact is, you're probably just getting by. But down here in Latin America, you can live on half of that after tax 25,000. And even then, you live a little bit higher on the hog than you lived on 25,000 up in the first world. So my point is this. If you've got $100,000 in savings, $100,000 that you've paid taxes on already, don't think that it's just going to last you 4 years down here like it might up in the first world. You can automatically figure 8 or even 10 good years living on that. Unless, of course, the U.S. dollar implodes, which is a distinct possibility. But you know, all of us who had a little savings when we came down here, we worry in the back of our minds what's going to happen when that money runs out. Are we going to be destitute, living like a vagabond on the beach? Or, God forbid, are we going to have to crawl back on our knees, back up to the United States, and face our family and friends like a big fat failure? And hear all those I told you so's, or even end up moving back into your old room at your mom and dad's house? Man, wouldn't that be a sad end to the story? Well, let me tell you, all of us expats have had those fleeting thoughts in the first few months that we've been down here. But you hear almost none of that stuff from expats who have toughed out the first year or year and a half. Because by then, almost every one of us has found a way not to dip into our savings anymore. Most of us by then are supporting ourselves with some kind of new unexpected income source, with a good majority of us adding to our savings already. But let me tell you, I know a few expat friends who came down with only $5,000 or $6,000, hoping to get in on a good thing or having a good idea or two and wishing to hook up with a partner and get started. But $5,000 or so is a scary little amount to start with. And only guys like expat Eddie, who came from nothing up in the first world, seem not to be overly preoccupied when their liquid money reserves dip down below $2,000 or $3,000. Eddie's the only first world guy I know who can put on a happy face and mean it when he's actually scraping the bottom of the barrel, and he has a few times. But but he always bounces back because this is Latin America. There's always another deal or a way to make money around the corner. Even if you're at the bottom of the barrel and only have $2,000 or $3,000 left, like Eddie's had a few times. Eddie's kind of a changed man now that he's a multimillionaire. But I wouldn't be surprised the way Eddie lives, that he ends up scraping the bottom a few more times before he checks out, and maybe even make a few more million along the way. Who knows? That's Eddie. But for those of you expats who have a good, solid career, you're an accountant or a lawyer or an engineer or a chemist or a systems manager, for you solid lifetime career guys, maybe all that stuff about starting your own small business is for the birds. You just don't want to get into that at all, and you want to continue getting a salary week by week from a transnational firm, because hell, they are down here now, aren't they? So why shouldn't you be able to transfer your talents down here? Even if you don't speak much Spanish, you're a smart person. You could pick it up fast. And I actually know some people who have done it. So now let me read an email from someone who's talking about just that. A listener who's wondering about how to get a job down here with a transnational corporation. He wants to jump right in where he left off in the first world, hoping to work for a transnational, since so many of them have landed down here already. It says, "Dear Johnny, I'm looking to move down to Colombia, hopefully Medellin or Cartagena, but probably Bogota, before the end of the year, and I could have an opportunity through my company to transfer down there, but I can't count on this. I'm in real estate development, finances, sales, and hotels. I would prefer to work for a multinational company, starting off there, as it will allow me to get to know the market, to figure out some business ideas, and make and even save some money. Just a few questions. I have started to expand my options beyond real estate. Are there any specific industries, companies you would recommend beyond the obvious oil and mining? Where should I look for multinational companies that are hiring for Colombian positions? I believe you said the Wall Street Journal would be good, but I can't find the classifieds online." Okay, here goes. And here's my answer to that. Some international newspapers do not have their classified ads online, because if it's an international paper, like the Wall Street Journal, they have international, local, and regional advertising sections. An Indonesian edition, a North American edition, a European edition, you get the idea. So it's only natural that you probably don't get the ads in a downloaded Wall Street Journal. But here's what you can do. You can buy a Wall Street Journal, how about that? You can download or buy a Financial Times from Europe, which is that pinkish-orange paper, or you could buy Forbes or any one of the business magazines. And in the back, they'll have first-world jobs in foreign countries. You'll see dozens of them. And they'll pay first-world wages, maybe even more, because they figure most first-world persons would never want to pick up and leave and go down to a third-world country without some kind of financial incentive. In fact, I remember in my last year of engineering school, on the jobs board there were some big first-world companies that were offering jobs in Saudi Arabia and the Dew Point, which was some missile monitoring site way up in Canada. And because it was so isolated, and the one in Saudi Arabia, so strange culturally, they were offering twice or more the average starting salary for young engineers coming right out of school. And needless to say, I didn't want to work at the Dew Point, because back then there was no such thing as iPods or DVDs yet. So you're talking about a severe case of cabin fever. And they were talking about a year contract. Anyway, just buy a Wall Street Journal, a Forbes, a Business Week, or the Financial Times, and check the back sections out in those. And if you don't like what you see there, there's even a better alternative. All you have to do, if you're going to Colombia, let's say, is pick a couple of big cities you might be interested in. Medellin, Cali, or Bogota, just check out their biggest circulation papers online, or go to a big public library in the States and they'll have them in the archives. And here's what you'll see when you look in the job wanted ads. And believe me, sometimes there's dozens and dozens of wanted ad pages. And once you take a look at them, you'll notice quickly that out of about every 50 ads that are in Spanish, you'll find an ad or two that's completely in English. And why do they do that? Obviously, they're looking for people who can read those ads in English. People like you, career people, because most all of those ads are by transnationals looking for an English-speaking, first-world-trained career person. Companies like Siemens and Price Waterhouse and Xerox looking for managers and chemists and systems engineers and accountants and sales professionals, just to name a few. And man, down here in Latin America, there are tons of sales jobs, and a lot of these ads are in English, which means they want you, as an English speaker, to whip your sales crew into shape first-world style. That's obviously what they want to hire you for, since Latin businesses and companies fall short in all their attempts to become first world and are specifically lacking in first world detail. Now, for example, I'm looking at the biggest El Salvador newspaper, and Price Waterhouse has an ad in English looking for a systems manager. And when you look at that ad, at the credentials this guy's got to have, and his job responsibilities, and the fact that he's going to be a high-level team leader or department head, Well, you got to know that a job like that in the States probably pays around $90,000 to $100,000, probably more. But down here, they're offering just a shade under $30,000 a year. But down here, you can live like you make more than $100,000 on only $30,000 a year, because things are not only much cheaper down here, but another huge bonus that almost no one ever talks about is the fact that if you make $95,100 or less in a foreign country and have your residence outside of the United States, you pay no income taxes on that money. So if your income originates from outside of the States and you live more than 180 days a year outside of the U.S., you're completely exempt from the first $95,100 in your income. You pay no tax on that. And it's completely legal. It's called the Foreign Earned Income Exclusion. And another reason why, if you have anything near a first world salary down here in Latin America, you can live more than twice as well on less than half the money. So if you're lucky and your transnational employer permits it, you can get transferred down here and work for your first world company and get a first world salary based on what you made up in the company when you were in the States. And of course, they'll give you relocation expenses and sometimes what they even call hardship pay, which is a bonus for disrupting your lifestyle up in the first world and dropping you into the disagreeable black hole of the third world. And on that kind of money, you'd be nuts to ever want to go back to the first world treadmill. Ever wonder why people who get transferred from a first world transnational company down to a third world branch almost never come back? I guess they know something we don't know, right? Well, we know it now. Or you can look for a job down here in a first world business magazine or newspaper. And finally, you can look for those English want ads in the local newspapers down here in the country you're thinking of moving to. Though you'll make half or less what that job paid up in the first world. But you'll still be living like a king, even if it looks like you've been slapped in the face. If you're making $100,000 a year as a CPA up in Cleveland, I realize a pay cut down to $30,000 looks pretty bleak. But you shouldn't look at it that way till you've really done the numbers. And yes, even though the ads down here in the big newspapers might be completely in English, often they'll have a minimum Spanish requirement of, let's say, 75% Spanish fluency. So if you plan on going that route, you better start boning up on your Spanish. Oh, and one last thing. Since a huge number of call centers have landed down here, I noticed that every so often in the paper, they advertise in English for 100% English-speaking managers. And of course, that means preferably gringos who can come down and whip these guys into shape. You know, take all the slang and street talk out of the guys who are actually on the phones doing the calling. Because the vast majority of people doing the calling at those call centers, they're mostly illegal aliens who'd been up in the States for a while, got caught, and got shipped back to their home countries. But they need English-speaking first-world managers like you to polish off their rough edges. Because you can't have your call center boys using words like ese, Holmes, cabrón, and puta when talking to an irate grandma from Cleveland when she rings up the Sears customer service line.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Once again, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.